Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Depending on how you look at it, the corporate news of the day is either surprising or overdue. Boeing and what happens now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 23rd day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It took 8 days from the second fatal crash of Boeing 737 MAX this past March to the plane being grounded worldwide. From that date to today, a bit more than 9 months. 9 months that, as of this morning, has cost Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg his job. The unknown, of course, is whether a new person in the C-suite at Boeing is going to make a difference. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has been on the Boeing story for us. He is here in the studio with me now. Hey, Jack.
Hi, Kai.
Why now did this happen?
It has come as a bit of a surprise. I was talking to some analysts this morning, and they were saying, you know, they weren't really expecting this right now. A few people have been calling for Muilenburg to go since really the crashes happened, particularly the families of the victims. Yeah. They've wanted him out. They've wanted somebody to be answerable and responsible. Others have argued that there's an argument for leaving management in place to clean up their own mess effectively, yeah, or to put it another way, a stability of management in these times of crisis. You know, get this mess sorted out, get this crisis fixed, get that plane back in the air, and then replace your management team and give the new team that comes in a fresh start, a clean slate.
And we should say, not that long ago, the then chairman of the board said he's doing a fine job, Mr. Muilenburg.
Yeah, and you know, in a lot of ways, he has been. Over the last 4 years or so that he's been right. CEO, Boeing has done really well. You had an interview with him earlier this year where you remarked that, you know, last year, 2018, was a record year for deliveries for Boeing. And then this 737 MAX issue has not been handled so well by the management team, and that has now cost him his job.
Okay, so now this company, what happens with it?
Well, getting the 737 MAX back in the air is just critically important for Boeing. This plane is its fastest-selling plane in the company's history. It's its big moneymaker. Boeing has almost 5,000 orders, and it delivered about 400 of those before the plane was grounded. So it really needs to get these planes recertified and get them back in the air. That's the big priority for the company.
Is this going to make that happen any faster?
It's really not. I mean, I can't see a way that a change in CEO is going to influence getting that plane back into the sky at the moment. I mean, for starters, it's not Boeing's decision. And that's perhaps one of the things that the new CEO is going to have to grapple with. Until now, Boeing has kind of had this attitude, certainly the way that it seems to outsiders, is that it thinks it's in control of this timeline of getting this plane back into the air. And it has been, you know, putting out these deadlines that are constantly pushed back. But really, it's not Boeing's decision. It's regulators around the world that are going to have to decide that this plane is ready to fly. They've been a little bit burnt by this whole process. You know, they now really want to make sure that they are seen as doing their job really, really well, really clearly. And so they're going to take their time over it.
And we should say, Steve Dixon, the head of the FAA, had a conversation with Muilenburg like 10 days, 2 weeks ago, in which he is reported to have said, in essence, Dennis, cut it out. This plane gets back in the sky when I say it gets back in the sky.
You're pushing us. You're pushing us too hard and too fast. And you know, it's safety first. And so I think that's one of the things that the new CEO is going to have to really grapple with is rebuilding that relationship with regulators, with the FAA, and making it more of the collaborative relationship that it's supposed to be to make sure that these things get, you know, done the way that they're supposed to be. Safety first.
Dennis Calhoun, the new CEO. We should just get that name in there. Dave Calhoun, rather. Sorry. Dave Calhoun, the new CEO of Boeing. Very quickly, in the 30 seconds we have left, the flying public. This is where I ended with you last time when they stopped production of the 737 MAX. Got to get people on these planes, right?
They have. I think, again, you know, the delay, we just have to see it as hopefully a positive thing. The regulators and Boeing cannot get this wrong. This plane will have effectively been completely rebuilt. It could almost be classed as a new generation of 737, maybe even a rebranding, as President Trump once suggested, might be a good thing. Hopefully, all this will lead to safer planes.
Jack Stewart on the Boeing story for us the past couple of weeks. Jack, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Boeing shares this Monday before Christmas up almost 3%. Wider markets up as well. Not quite as much, though. Details, numbers when we get there. There was a moment or two about a year or so ago when conventional wisdom was that Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, was going to make a run for the White House. In the end, as we all know, he didn't. And one of the reasons is what threatens to turn into the defining issue of his time in office: homelessness, what the city's doing about it and what it's not. Garcetti's been the mayor here since 2013, after 12 years on the city council.
Good morning.
Hey, Mr. Mayor. How are you, sir?
I'm good. You checking out the books?
Yeah, of course I am. And the pictures, too. Did your dad take these pictures of the skateboard? So out at the mayor's official residence last week after checking out the library and an area rug that at first glance is a bit, well, eclectic, but which, if you look at it for a minute, you realize is a map of L.A.
Do you recognize the rug?
Of course I recognize the rug. We've already had a whole conversation about it.
So did you figure out where we are?
Yeah, vaguely we're sort of like here somewhere, right?
Well, that's actually the 10.
After the geography quiz, we settled in. And I asked Garcetti, in the 6 years he's been the mayor, what the biggest change has been.
I think the biggest thing that's changed in Los Angeles has been that we're a victim of our own success. We wouldn't have imagined coming out of the recession how strong I think the economy would be. But with that comes more jobs than infrastructure. So whether it's traffic or housing, I think the two things that still hold us back, it's so many people still want to be here that now I think our greatest challenge is to figure out how we can build that out, and not just build it out to accommodate today, but for like the next 25 years.
So let's talk about those two things you mentioned, infrastructure and housing. We'll go to housing first, because homelessness, of course, is, this is going to sound worse than I mean it to, it's the signature problem of the city right now.
No question.
Is it a policy failure, or is it a housing market failure?
Well, homelessness is trauma meets high rent. And I try to simplify it. Everybody who's homeless has some sort of trauma, economic, psychological, personal. That used to live indoors, but when the housing market is so expensive, it goes outside or into cars or shelters. It is decades of failure. Give you one stat. If we just had the level of funding from the state and the feds for affordable housing, we would have built 20,000 more units of affordable housing. And we've got about 30,000 people on the street, so everybody could have been in that. Yeah. That's just the level it was before cuts. For me as a mayor, I always remind people the city has very little statutory authority. It doesn't keep me from being a very loud voice. But to understand it, we have to see not just how it affects folks who are homeless and unhoused, but all of us in this housing market. You don't have to be homeless to feel that failure to build for 2.5 decades.
You're the guy, though, for as little sort of statutory influence as you have, you can be the loudest voice. You're the guy who's on the hook.
Yes.
You've had some success with ballot measures and funding, clearly not enough. You say by 2028, when the Olympics come, you want this to be a solved problem, street homelessness. Can you get there for real?
We can, but we have to decide, and our national and state leaders have to decide whether or not they want to do this. Every country that solved homelessness has a right to housing. There is in Japan, where the president visited and said how clean the streets were 20 years ago, a huge homeless population. And their federal government said, everybody who is unhoused will be housed on our dime. That kind of pisses off conservatives. Mm-hmm. When that's there, then people can say nobody can sleep on the street. That might piss off some liberals. And right now, we also have the larger housing problem. Certainly, I can't, and the city of Los Angeles can't solve on its own. But LA City is building 25% of all the housing in the state of California, and we're 10% of the population. It can't just be put on one city to solve this housing crisis. But can we solve it? Absolutely.
Second thing you mentioned in terms of the growth of the city in the last 6 years, as you've been on watch, as it were, infrastructure.
Yes.
Public transit, roads, and yet we're jammed. And it takes people hours to get to work, and it's lost time and resources.
That's exactly how I describe it. Because infrastructure, people's eyes glaze over. Yeah. You say time with your daughter to tuck her into bed, or the line you draw around a map for your dating pool if you're single, because of how long it takes to get to a date.
You didn't do that.
Did you do that?
You're in Los Angeles.
I didn't do it, but I'm sure somebody does now, because literally you're not going to date somebody in Arcadia if you live in Santa Monica. You're just not going to. You know, it might be the love of your life, but it's too far away.
I say that to people who don't live in LA, and they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, that's the way it is.
So I kind of, when I came in as mayor, I said, what were we thinking for the last 30, 40 years? No public transportation to LAX, no build out of lines, a hope that we'd get more freeways. You can't double deck anything more. There's no space to put a new freeway. And so I kind of took the 25 to 50 year look. I put all my political capital on the line to pass what's now the largest infrastructure measure on transportation in U.S. history, Measure M. That's 15 rapid transit lines in a single city. That's part of the solution, is to build that rapid transit and public transit system. And I also this year want us to look a little bit more aggressively. What can we do with technologies to embed lights, to switch lanes, the directions of lanes on streets? What can we do to encourage people to get out of their cars by making, for instance, buses free, which I've made for students for the first time with our LADOT buses, and hopefully with Metro soon? What can we do to make sure that people are looking at other options that are there? And what short-term things can we do while we know the build-out is coming?
Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
We're going to go back to the economic history books for this next story, and a phrase you might have last heard in high school. Most favored nation is the phrase, and its use is prompted by the news that as of the first of the year, China says it's going to be cutting tariffs on more than 800 products, including frozen pork, which they desperately need, also some medicines as well, and it's cutting those tariffs for all of its trading partners, everybody, which will bring the taxes, the import taxes on those items, below levels currently enjoyed by, here you go, most favored nations. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra is on explainer duty today.
The WTO's most favored nations rule says countries have to treat all of their trading partners equally. They can't raise tariffs on pork from one country, but not another. Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Tariffs need to be the same for all trading partners as long as they're members of the WTO, which almost all countries are.
There are some exceptions. For one thing, countries can raise tariffs on a trading partner if they prove it's behaving badly.
The country is dumping its products at an unfairly low price, or the government is heavily subsidizing the products.
But the normal rules went out the window in the U.S.-China trade war. Chad Bown is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The United States just gave up on the rules and just decided it was going to unilaterally impose these tariffs on China.
China retaliated in kind. Then they both tattled on each other to the WTO. Now, though, the U.S. and China are playing nice again. They've cut a deal that will likely treat the U.S. better than China's other trading partners. And that's not allowed. Remember that whole most favored nations thing? So China says it's going to lower tariffs on everybody. Chad Bown has a theory on this.
They're basically trying to make the argument to Europe and Japan and South Korea that we have to do certain things toward the United States. But with respect to our trade with you, we're going to continue to follow the WTO rules.
Regardless of the rules, there's a good reason for China to give these other countries equal treatment. It doesn't want to make them mad. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Thank you for your consideration during this festive or not festive time.
Whether you are celebrating or not, everybody needs a day off now and then, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 96 points on this Monday, 0.3%, 28,551. The NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.2%, 89.45. The S&P 500 advanced 2 points. We'll call that flat, 32.24. Jack and I were talking about Boeing, up 2.9%. Today, BMW dropped 1.3% in the United States after a report that American regulators are investigating the German car company's sales practices. Audi up 0.5%. Sports betting company DraftKings is going public in an unusual way. An already public company is going to take over and then change its name to DraftKings. Shares in what will soon be DraftKings, but is now still Diamond Eagle Acquisition, rose nearly 12% today. You follow all that? You're listening to Marketplace. Here at Marketplace, our mission goes beyond reporting the news. It's to make people smarter about the economy through reliable, independent journalism. Your support is what makes it all possible. Whether you donate a little or a lot, being a Marketplace investor makes you a partner in that mission. If you're already giving, thank you so much for going above and beyond. If not, well, look, there's still time. Donate today at Marketplace.org, and thanks for believing in what we do.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Instagram is, among many other things, a marketing necessity for brands right now, especially up-and-coming wannabe brands. A brand like a clothing company called Fashion Nova. It's gotten some social media love from the likes of Cardi B and the Kardashians, but how it makes its clothes and how those workers right here in Los Angeles, by the way, are treated was the subject of a story in the New York Times the other day. Natalie Kitchweff wrote it. Natalie, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
Low though it has 17 million Instagram followers, a whole lot of people listening to this are probably not familiar with Fashion Nova. So give us the skinny, would you?
This is a retailer that has basically perfected fast fashion for the Instagram era. It's a mostly online retailer, and they do business in part by getting influencers, celebrities, micro-influencers to help market their clothes on Instagram and social media. They mass-produce cheap clothes that look expensive for, you know, young people who want to wear as many new outfits as possible.
The mass production part is the through line of this article and the reason we called you. Tell us how they get their clothes made so quickly and so cheaply.
So they have a very low price point, and they're churning out more than 1,000 new styles every week. So how do you do that? In part, the way that they do that is by working with manufacturers based in Los Angeles. Now, they don't directly contract with the factories that make their clothes. They deal with middlemen who sell them samples, and those middlemen get the clothes made in factories that are all around Los Angeles. A lot of the time, the Labor Department has found those factories are paying their workers far less than the minimum wage, and that's part of the reason why the price point can be so low.
You say far less than minimum wage. We're talking like $2 and $3 an hour here, right?
That's right. In 50 investigations conducted from 2016 to 2019, the Labor Department found that these factories owed $3.8 million in back wages to their workers, and that the workers, yes, were getting paid as little as $2.77 an hour.
Okay, there's a quote from somebody in this piece, and I apologize for forgetting who it is, but he basically says, look, American consumers accept this as happening in Bangladesh or Vietnam, but it's happening here in the United States, in major cities. How is this legal?
It's not legal. But, you know, the issue for the Department of Labor, and that was a former Department of Labor official who said that, is that they can't hold retailers accountable if the retailers can credibly claim that they didn't know that these clothes were made by workers who were illegally underpaid. And so, yes, factories have and can be punished. But, you know, they keep popping up. They change their names. They get new digs. And so the problem persists.
Mercedes Cortez is one woman who you spoke with for this piece. Describe her working conditions for me, would you?
So she worked in a factory that was filled with cockroaches and rats. Smells like a bathroom. I visited the old place that she used to work. You know, she earned as little as under $4 an hour. She was paid by the piece, meaning a couple of cents to do each task on a garment, a hemline, sleeves. And so, you know, you find workers like this all over Los Angeles who are really relying on just sheer willpower to get them through 11-hour days. Hmm. And, you know, often they're leaving with as little as $40 for that day.
Fashion Nova, as you say in the piece, credibly denies, that's how they are allowed to continue, they credibly deny knowledge of these conditions. There are must be other fast fashion outfits out there doing the same kinds of things, right? Can't just be Fashion Nova.
That's right. You know, the Labor Department has warned Forever 21, TJ Maxx, Ross stores. But, you know, part of the issue is that it's not something that retailers feel a ton of accountability for, both legally, but also with their consumers. I mean, when you think about what people want when they go online to buy something, it's often to pay as little as possible.
Natalie Kitchoff. She's a business reporter at the New York Times. Natalie, thanks a lot. Good talking to you as always.
Thanks, Kai.
For all the convenience online shopping brings, and it brings a lot, there is a not small downside as well. More package deliveries means more chances those packages don't get where they're going. The University of Washington did some checking. Researchers there figure about 15% of packages delivered in urban areas don't make it to the recipient on the first try. That's thanks to theft or nobody home to sign for it or just plain old delivery to the wrong address. So a lot of people have found a seemingly simple solution to that problem. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has it.
Aaron Westover's office is starting to feel a little like Santa's workshop with a constant parade of little boxes and big ones.
I've gotten a bunch of gifts and I've also just been trying to furnish my house and get everything I need for my house. I bought my boyfriend the 88-key keyboard for Christmas, and so that just got delivered.
All to her place of work. Westover is a sales manager at a hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where there's always someone at the front desk to receive deliveries day and night. She's had packages stolen off her porch at home. Plus, that 5-foot keyboard box for her boyfriend is kind of obvious.
I don't want him to see the size or get any inkling of what it could be, so I still have it in my office.
Getting personal packages delivered to work can be problematic, says business consultant Alexandra Levitt.
You've got to mind how things look, the perception.
She says one or two items every once in a while is probably no big deal, but gifts for the whole family might raise alarms.
Because it's going to cause people to look at what you're doing, what time you spent getting those items, perhaps using the mailroom as your own personal delivery service. It just doesn't look good.
Just ask Meredith McCarthy, who's on the receiving end of all those deliveries. She's the facilities manager for a tech company in Waltham, Massachusetts, with about 500 employees, where she says personal packages were getting out of hand.
Things like Amazon, Rent the Runway, you know, Stitch Fix, food delivery. It was becoming too much around the holiday season.
They have a small mailroom, just 100 square feet to fit all those boxes.
Once that room gets filled, then we start putting them in our reception area and then as well into our kitchen area, which is not ideal.
So they banned them.
We typically send out a note to all of our employees that no personal packages should be delivered between Thanksgiving through January 1st.
It's a common policy at public institutions like state universities where taxpayer dollars are used to sort and deliver mail. Package bans are also popping up in the private sector from law offices to pharmaceutical companies. While employers might not be happy about it, getting packages delivered to businesses rather than homes has its upside, says Adi Tomer, a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Whether you're in the suburbs or the city, jobs are much denser than where people live. So you're reducing the amount of stops for the truck delivery.
Better for the driver, better for traffic, and better for the environment. Of course, maybe not better for the bottom lines of the businesses that have to devote resources to deal with your latest Amazon haul. But Tomer says companies could spin that to their advantage.
You could see this being actually a real benefit, that it's like, hey, yeah, no problem, especially young millennial. You can get your packages delivered here. Like, it is a new kind of boutique benefit.
Personal package service, the new kombucha bar or ping pong table for today's e-commerce obsessed workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
People celebrate all kinds of holidays in December, not just the one day after tomorrow. But no matter the cause of the celebration, there are going to be a whole lot of empty offices this week and next, and therefore a whole lot of out-of-office emails ready to go. We are highlighting some of them in our series, Automatic Reply.
This is a general notice informing you of the absence of Kelsey Berteaux until Tuesday. Kelsey has chosen to exercise her right to partake in the traditions of a certain holiday which may or may not be denominational or non-denominational. Kelsey is in no way endorsing or not endorsing said holiday, nor encouraging or discouraging employees of all demographic clusters to engage in celebratory activities. Thank you for your consideration during this festive or not festive time.
Kelsey Berteaux is a paralegal, in case you couldn't tell. She's in Lehigh, Utah. Tell us, would you, about an out-of-office email you've seen. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, Tesla CEO Elon Musk having a little more fun on Twitter. The electric car company shares hit $420 a piece today, which, you might recall, was the price that Musk joked about in August of 2018 in a tweet that said, considering taking Tesla private at $420, funding secured. We all laughed once we figured it out. The SEC did not. Musk settled fraud charges and wound up paying $20 million and stepping down as chairman. Anyway, today, with $420 the actual price, Musk tweeted, "Whoa, the stock is so high, LOL." No word from the SEC. All right, that is what we got. The Dow Industrial's up 96 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.